bank here who's got his own billiard room.
Yes, what do you call it, Kramer?
The billiard room.
No.
The
billiard? Not billiards. What? Not the billiards. It was...
Come on, everybody. What? Come on.
We call it the place to be.
The place to be, yeah.
Then I shall be there.
Now, it's time. Live and in living color, the Grandy Man can...
Time to play the game!
Well, you always left me satisfied and smiling.
That's what she said!
Why do I want this?
Yeah.
Because I want to make bank, bro. I want to get ass. I want to drive a Range Rover.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages, it is now time for the Place to Be podcast. And now your hosts, Justin Rosero and Scott Cristolo.
PTB Nation, welcome back to the Man Cave. It is the Place to Be podcast. I am Scott Criscolo. I haven't had a chance to open in a while. This is kind of cool. I usually say to my left when I did my old radio show, but I guess he's to my right, because that's the phone on this side of the Man Cave board, is my co-host, as always, Mr. Justin Rosero. Good evening, sir.
It's my PIC, Scott Criscolo. How are you doing tonight?
There we go. All right, good. The PICs are in the house.
Yeah, I am pumped. I couldn't wait all day today. I was bouncing off the walls because we have... As me and Gene Okerlund would always say, my longtime, close, good personal friend with us here tonight.
Yes, been looking forward to this for a long time.
The man known now as RJ Brewer on Lucha Libre USA, otherwise known as John Walters. John, welcome aboard.
Hey, thanks for having me. How long have we been friends now?
Too long, I think. Right, at least 12 years or so, 10 or 11. Wow. Or actually, if we do the Shawn Michaels Triple H math, it's like 16 years. So.
Well, we'll pretend it's only 2 or 3 because 12 makes me seem old.
Yeah, it does. Well, you are old. But you know what? You still look like you're like 21, so I will say that.
Perfect. That's all that matters.
So, all right, yeah, thanks for joining us, and we'll kind of get right into things. What we wanted to do is maybe just run through your career a little bit, and then you have asked to make this a little bit no-holds-barred interview, so we got some good questions, yeah. I think, at the end for you.
Yeah, what's an interview if you can't go all out? So, yeah, ask me whatever.
That's a great that's a great answer for a wrestler. To just go all out, because you know it gets, sometimes these interviews get too cushy. So we applaud your candor. It's going to be fun.
Well, if you have something to hide, they do. But
yeah, that's true too.
Very true. So let's talk about your early days. And this is you know, where we met was back at Assumption College in Worcester. Working together in some theater and TV production class projects. And so why don't you tell us? You know, you played high school football. You played college football for a couple of years. Got hurt. Or you had a cyst in your neck, you had to have that removed, that kind of ended your days as a football player. What made you get into wrestling and seek out Killer Kowalski to go train with him?
Well, you know, like most people who start off as pro wrestlers, and it's cliche to say, but I was a big fan growing up, and it was always something I kind of envisioned, but, you know, I was kind of your typical high school kid. I want to graduate high school, go to college, play sports in college, so... To me, it wasn't really something that I was planning on pursuing right away. But, you know, I started bulking up for college. I think this summer after my senior year in high school, I put like 25 pounds on one summer. And at that point, you know, I was doing it primarily for football. But, you know, when the politics of the college football team kicked in and I really had no desire to play anymore, I kind of lost the love for football. It was that time that I decided to start wrestling. So I sent a bunch of letters out, you know, applications to wrestling schools, somewhere in Ohio, West Thatcher School in Ohio, I think. Shawn Michaels was opening a school around the time. But realistically, I wanted to finish college, so I knew I had to stay local, and Killer Kowalski, who's, you know, one of the greatest trainers and produced some of the greatest talent, was, you know, an hour and a half away from where I was going to college. So to me, that seemed like the perfect fit, so I could finish school and train at the same time. So that's what I did.
I have two questions pertaining to this. The first one, and I've been waiting, dying to hear this. Is there anything at Charlie's that's that could be memorabilia, like a signed, you know, points card receipt or something that maybe can go on the wall at Charlie's, maybe, or the cafeteria?
I wish I held more stuff from college, but unfortunately, most of my college weekends were wrestling. If I wasn't training, I was going to shows to watch the local guys, and I started working shows when I was a senior in college, so I didn't spend too much time. On campus, and unfortunately, I think I remember high school more than I do college. And it wasn't because I was drinking all the time; it's just I was never really there, and I was kind of to myself, with the exception of making videos with Justin. You know,
I was gonna say I think I probably have more footage of memorabilia of you than you probably do.
Yeah, we're not gonna get those videos out on the web, not yet.
I'm waiting for you just to really, you know, break out big time on
one of
the big stages, so I can start making some money off that stuff.
Yeah, we'll wait a little bit for that. But I don't know. I don't think I have much memorabilia from Assumption. I think it's
So obviously, training with Killer Kowalski, WWE Hall of Famer, God rest his soul. Obviously, he's trained plenty of wrestlers in his career. Obviously, the big one being Triple H. Did any of these guys come around? Did you see anybody while you were training come in and help out, or just kind of observe while you were there? Or was it pretty much just students and him?
You know, I started in January of 2000, and by then Walter was pretty limited to what he could do. He was still coming to the school every day, and he was still, you know, showing guys who wanted to learn from him stuff. But, you know, he physically could only get in the ring, you know, once a session. And the stuff he would show you was more stuff in the back room, more shoot moves and stuff like that. But he did get in there, and he did show some stuff. You know, you would have some guys show up, you know, some of his ex-students. I know. Right, a couple weeks after I started, Rick Martel showed up, who wasn't one of the students, but he was friendly. The Hearts were friendly with Walter, so Rick Martel showed up. You know, Perry Saturn would show up here and there. I know China showed up once, but I wasn't there. So, you know, people did come back here and there. A lot of his ex-students who didn't really make it too big but still were solid workers would show up. So there was always guys coming in and out that were there to help guys, and it was pretty valuable to have them there.
Now, one of your first early big shows was actually at Assumption, the cystic fibrosis benefit, which was impressive because, you know, as a college senior, you're just breaking into the business, you're training, you know, you're doing little spot shows here and there, and this show you pretty much put on, you know, set up, promoted yourself, and we had a good turnout, and just tell us maybe just for a minute about the reaction you received, because that is something I do have on tape, and you do get, like, a huge ovation coming into that gym. How did that make you feel? Did it make you feel early on like a lot of that was paying off and you made the right decision?
Yeah, I mean, that was probably the most nervous I've ever been. I was probably more nervous for that particular match than I was for, like, even WWE Dark matches or you know, whether I was debuting on TV for MTV or doing Ring of Honor or whatever. It seemed like that was probably the most nerve-wracking for me because I had just been training about 6 months. So it wasn't so much, was I going to get hurt, you know, was I going to mess up in front of, you know, hundreds of my friends. That's kind of what my main concern was. You know, once I got WWE Dark matches and that kind of stuff, and, you know, I started wrestling some stars on the independents, I felt comfortable in the ring at that point where I wasn't worried about looking bad. But the Assumption match in front of that many people that you knew and being so limited in the matches I've had, I probably only had three or four matches at that point, or maybe a little more. But anyway, you know, that was nerve-wracking. But the ovation was great. It was cool. You know, you have goosebumps that you can't really explain to people when something like that happens, you know. But it was awesome. It was good. And you know, the money went for a good cause, and none of the guys hesitated to come in and work for free. So it was cool. It was definitely a cool night.
I think I still remember your match with Slick Wagner Brown, move by move, after commentating and editing it and watching that show a million times. So it was definitely a fun show. So now from there, you went, you know, you started working Chaotic Wrestling, which is based out of the same area around where you were training. But also around that time, you sent a tape in, a masterful edited tape, into Tough Enough. For the first season, can you tell us a little bit about that experience and how that was? And, you know, was it what you expected or totally different than what
you you know, a lot of different people had sent, you know, the guys that I was wrestling with sent in Tough Enough tapes. But the confusing thing to me was the show was basically a teaching guys how to wrestle. And a lot of guys that went in for auditions knew how to wrestle already, and that seemed to prevent them from getting in because they knew too much already. And that didn't make any sense to me. The tape other people sent in showed them in actual matches. So if they want to teach guys headlocks and how to hit the ropes, I wouldn't expect them to pick guys who already knew how to wrestle. So that was kind of confusing. I think I made it to like the second round or third round or something, and then they just, you know, told, you know, said no from there. But I don't regret it at all. I think the road I took is more beneficial for me that I actually learn more. You know, mm-hmm. A lot of those tough enough guys, with the exception of maybe Morrison, I don't think any of them are still there. I could be wrong. I don't know. But a lot of them have had short careers, and maybe it was because they didn't go out there and actually work the independent circuit and learn how to master the craft. So that might have prevented them from going farther. It could have been attitude. Who knows? You never really know. But it was a cool experience. And you know, again, I was pretty early in my career at that point, so it was definitely an experience. But I'm glad the way it worked out. I'm not too upset that I didn't make it on the show.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure you were on the pilot. I think you made it to that like final cut before the guys that were going to be on the show itself. And I have had a few guys. Actually, it seems like, you know, along with you, guys that didn't make the cut or didn't win actually ended up being more successful, because like you said, they kind of had to hit that indie road, maybe go overseas and learn a little bit the hard way,
right,
as opposed to going through the developmental system. Okay, so from there, you know, you spent a lot of time in Chaotic Wrestling, won a bunch of titles, kind of. That's really where you, I believe, where you kind of cut your teeth and began to grow as a wrestler. Is there anything you want to talk about during your time there?
Yeah, Chaotic was definitely the promotion out of all the independent promotions when I first started working. They were the one that really gave me the ball and really let me do my thing. You know, other promotions did too, but Chaotic was at the time known as one of the better in the country. You know, not just New England, but they had a working relationship with the WWE, and they had they had some solid guys there. They had a school affiliated with it where guys were trained, so guys were tight, you know, tight knit there. And it was great. I mean, they put me in different kind of matches. I got different experiences, and every month my character got to evolve there. So it really was really good. Chaotic was definitely a stepping stone for me, and you know, I still go back to do shows for them, you know, every so often, and the reaction I get is still pretty cool, because you know, it's a lot of the same fans from the early days. But you know, like anything, there's only so much you can grow doing working for a promotion that you've been to a million times. So you know, my appearances there are few and far between, but it's still cool to go back there and the same building that I wrestled in 8 years ago and see a lot of the same fans. So Chaotic was great. You know, they definitely put me on the map, and I think Chaotic was one of the reasons I got looked at by WWE, because they were doing the camps at Chaotic and coming to scout the show. So it was nothing bad to say about working there.
Now, while you were in Chaotic, John, you also did some stuff for the EWA, the Eastern Wrestling Alliance. As a matter of fact,
yep,
according to this, you actually were a dual champion. You were the New England heavyweight champion, and you were the
right
regular heavyweight champion. It's pretty impressive, even for any kind of promotion. According to this, it says that you lasted, it says you were champion until February of 2003, when you were stripped of both titles for no-showing. Was that a storyline no-show? Did something happen? What was that about?
That's a good question, because I can't even remember. I was stripped of, you know what, I think it was a storyline where I actually jumped a guy that was injured and I got suspended. But I think what happened was I had started working for EWA. They ran shows up in Maine. And then at one point I moved down to New Jersey for 5 months just to work down there, to work in Delaware, to work in Jersey, because I felt like I needed a little escape from Mass, because I wanted to get my name out more. That was, you know, right around the time I started working for Ring of Honor and ECWA down in Delaware. So I kind of left the New England scene, and I think that might have been the storyline they used for me to get me out of there, you know. So I've never no-showed an event in my life, so that's probably definitely a storyline thing that is.
It was around that time, too, now you started doing a little bit of work with WWE. You did some dark matches. You also did some on-air stuff, including, you know, being at WrestleMania 20 as one of the Druids. But any good stories backstage or anything that you experienced, positive or negative, while, you know, doing those few months work for them?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, anytime you're back there and you see the production value of the company, there's no doubt when you're back there you know why they're number one. You know, their production is top-notch. They're very organized. You know, there's times where their wrestling isn't the writing isn't that good, the wrestling isn't that good. WWE is always going to be number one in pro wrestling. I don't think that's ever going to change. They're the NFL of wrestling, and there's a reason for it. It's just well organized from top to bottom. I had great opportunities to do dark matches, Sunday Night Heat matches, Velocity. There were times where I went, I wasn't used, and I was still paid. That was nice, you know. There were times where I got used for backstage skits. So I'd say for about 2.5 to 3 years, I was pretty much working for them anytime they were on the East Coast. I mean, I remember even driving as far down to D.C. to work for them. So, you know, and there was a point where they even told me they were going to offer me something that never came. But, yeah, I mean, there was a lot of great experiences. I got to wrestle you know, wrestle some competitive matches, some not so competitive matches where I was in there for a couple minutes just getting tossed around. But, you know, you're hired to do something, you go in there and do it, and you know, you take the good from everything. Even if it's a 30-minute squash match, you learn from it, you know. And you know, I got some positive feedback from a lot of the guys back there. You know, Chris Benoit was one of the guys who went out of his way to help me, asking for my email address, you know, actually instant messaging me and talking to me, and he was pushing to try to get me a job. And then, you know, what happened there. So, mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of guys that were willing to help, some guys that were assholes. You know, it's just, you know, it is what it is. It's a business, but it's, overall, it's definitely good experience to be there one way or the other.
Yeah, I think I still have some tapes of your Velocity matches. I remember I used to check the spoilers every week during that couple-year stretch when, you know, you seem to be doing a lot of work for them, you know, hoping to catch a glimpse of you. And there were a lot of times I'd go to a show hoping you'd be on the dark match and, you know, contact you ahead of time. So it was always cool seeing you, who I always thought, you know, and we're going to get into a little bit of the fan reaction towards your work later, but, you know, just a very underrated in-ring wrestler. And I also think you catch a lot of flack for promo work, which I think has actually come a long way from when you first started. And when we saw you last year doing some of that heel work, was just, you know, I couldn't believe it was the same guy that, you know, we used to do interviews back in college, because I really just think you're an underrated, you know, performer in that aspect. But we'll get a little bit more into that as we go along. Any overseas experience that you've had that you want to talk about, whether it be England or, you know, Germany, Japan?
Yeah, I went to Japan, I forget the year at this point, it was probably 2007. Tatsumi Fujinami was starting up a promotion called Muga World Pro Wrestling, and I got on a 2-week tour with them. And Japan was somewhere I always wanted to wrestle. Loved it over there. Loved the culture. Loved the food. Loved the wrestling. The fans are it's different than over here. You know, over there they're studying your matches. They might be quiet for 10 minutes, then you snap on a submission hold and they start to clap. So it's a different style over there. And a lot of guys get nervous because they're saying, "Well, why aren't the fans reacting?" But it's a lot of they're studying the show, and they're really, you know, analyzing it. So it's a different kind of reaction than you get here in the States. You know, then I went to England about 2 years ago, spent 5 weeks over there, got to wrestle, you know, three, four shows a week over there for various promotions. Went to Germany for a show. Supposed to go back to Germany this past January, but had a big snowstorm, and I was supposed to fly out of Atlanta, and the airport was closed for 4 days, so that's all right. But I'm planning to, I am trying to get back there at some point this year. For a couple weeks, but with my Lucha Libre bookings, you know, pretty much once or twice a month, I have to keep that as my priority because that is where my contract is. So, but yeah, wrestling overseas is cool, and especially cool when those fans know who you are, and you know, they're cheering you or booing you when you walk out, you know, overseas, and you're getting that kind of reaction. That's pretty neat, you know.
So that actually is a good segue, because that's our next topic, is Lucha Libre USA, and you know, in our conversations prior to that, it seemed like maybe you wanted to start tapering off a little bit, and I think you were getting a little worn out being on the road and traveling and doing what you're doing, and then it seems like this opportunity came along for you to kind of get a new character and kind of, you know, mix things up a little bit. Tell us, you know, how they contacted you and, you know, how you feel with the company, and do you think it's something that is going to stick around on, you know, because MTV, they're not known really for, you know, giving shows, or especially wrestling shows, a very long leash, but, you know, this has been picked up for another season, and you know, where do you see this company headed, and do you see yourself being there for the long haul?
Yeah, I was, you know, I've been spending the past couple of winters down in Florida, and when I'm down here, I don't really wrestle. You know, I do the independents up in Massachusetts and the East Coast, but when I'm here in Florida, I just kind of, you know, relax for 3 or 4 months and work, you know, work, do some other stuff, and, you know, just kind of get away from the winters. And I want to think I'm going to transition to living here full-time at some point. I actually just bought a house down here, but yeah, I was. I had just got back to Massachusetts for the summer. It was, you know, middle of April or first week in May, some point, and I got an email from somebody that one of the writers said he was, you know, the head writer for Lucha Libre USA to be shown on MTV. They're interested in using me, and right away I just kind of, you know, I've gotten so many emails like that in the past for bookings for projects, and I just kind of shrugged it off, saying, hey, you know, until I see an airplane ticket or if I see a contract, and I'm not going to believe anything because it's wrestling. There's so much hot air, so much bullshit, you know. I just wasn't getting too excited about anything. So he asked me if I'd be interested, and at first I said Lucha Libre. I said, you got the wrong guy. I said, that's not my style. I can't flip around and I can't memorize shit, you know. So there's no way, you know, I think you got the wrong guy. But then when I emailed him back, he said he had a particular character in mind for me, and I was recommended to him by other people. So I gave him my number, and he called me, and he basically told me what the character they had in mind was. This R.J. Brewer character is going to be the son of Jan Brewer in Arizona, who's a very controversial politician over there. Some people love her, some people hate her, and basically she's the one that's trying to crack down on the illegal immigration and the you know, the border control in Arizona from Mexico. So he told me about the character, told me about, you know, the dates, and said that Mark Jindrak, who's scouting talent, who's in charge of booking talent, would be contacting me. He called me a couple weeks a couple days later, talked, you know, the figures seemed good, the guarantee was good. They emailed me over a contract a couple days later, I signed it, and that was pretty much it. Had my airfare for the first show in Palm Springs, you know, about a week later or so. And I think the show's going to, I think the promotion's going to last, because the Mexican market in the United States is so untapped, you know. And, you know, a lot of people don't know because they haven't been to these shows, but we haven't drawn under 1,000, 1,500 people except for, like, one show, you know. And these Mexican fans love their wrestling. They love Lucha Libre. So, and, you know, there's a reason Vince McMahon's pushing whatever, Dos Caras, whatever his name is now, Alberto
Del Rio.
Alberto Del Rio. Del Rio.
And they also just signed Mystico as well.
Well, yeah, because I know Rey Mysterio's slowing down, and there's been talks about him retiring. I don't know how accurate that is, but they need those Mexican stars to sell tickets over in Mexico and to, you know, relate and click with the Mexican fan base here. So it's a very untapped market, and, you know, these fans are hungry when they come to the shows. They want to see wrestling, and they're awesome fans to wrestle in front of because they're very easy. And my character is a blessing in disguise, because don't have to do much. It's just to be myself, turned up a notch. Not that I'm racist, but I just have to be hateful, and I just have to play my character. And you know, I did a lot of research when I first was offered the job. I did a lot of research on the immigration laws, you know, the Arizona statistics and murders, kidnappings, this and that. And I use a lot of that in my promo. And you know, my hat goes off to the writers there, because they let me, a lot of the promos they script, they let me say whatever I want to, so that helps out, you know.
It's almost like, it's almost, oh, I'm sorry, John, go ahead.
No, go ahead, I'm done, I can continue.
Yeah, no, that's okay. No, it's funny, this is an interesting character, because it's almost like a lower level, not lower level, but kind of a comparable to Sergeant Slaughter being the Iraqi sympathizer during the arc before WrestleMania 7. Here you are, very controversial character. Agree or disagree, irrelevant. I mean, you know, you could be watched it down there and walking through, you know, somehow being in Arizona or getting, I mean, do you get, like, you know, nasty hate mail or anything like that? Like, you know, do people sometimes go over the top with it?
I don't. There's been a lot of things that I've cleared with MTV that, you know, MTV hasn't wanted me to say, and then there's other things that they've said, go ahead and say it. You know, I think these fans know it's a show, and, you know, I even get fans waiting, you know, for an autograph or a picture afterwards, but all it takes is one person sometimes, you know what I mean, to really believe and to really, so I have to use caution, I have to be smart, but it's not going to stop me from doing my job either, you know, no, I mean, I think the character is great, and it probably wouldn't work in a WWE or TNA, but in a primarily Mexican-based wrestling promotion, with all masks, and my character hates the mask, hates the style, hates that these people are here working in my country. You know, it's fun. It's real easy, and I enjoy it. But you know, definitely got to be careful. You know, always be watching your back. So the best of both worlds there. You know, got to be careful, but I'm also loving it. You know?
I think it's a good promotion as well, because they seem to really be taking an old school approach. You know, basic storylines, you know, a lot of the action is focused on the ring and, you know, some backstage confrontations. And it seems like they are trying to bring that little bit of, you know, kayfabe back into the product, basically, where, you know, you're the son of the Arizona governor and you know, you're really pushing that character. And just a lot of the storylines, it is very, very basic the way you work the crowd. And I think it's good to see, because it's, you know, a lot of people want a TNA to become that alternative to WWE, and they are in a way, but, you know, they come off basically as a rip-off promotion most of the time. So it is nice to see, you know, another promotion along with Ring of Honor kind of on a mainstream, you know, television audience like that with a different kind of style.
Yeah, and you'll see in season two whenever it gets on the air, you know, I'm not so sure when that's going to be. It's supposed to be sometime this winter, but the appearance of the promotion has increased, you know, tenfold. And, you know, we got a couple new writers, one writer that actually worked on the set of The Dark Knight, so who's been awesome with me. He's been helping me work my character, and my promos have been 10 times better than they were, and I really believe in it, and I become that person when the camera comes on, you know. And we have a producer who used to produce Nitro and WWE shows too, so the production value of the show is going to be better. We're filming in the same arena now every month, so that helps. One of the main problems with the first season is that we were going to these different arenas, different lighting guys, different camera guys, different sound crew. There was no consistency in the product, and that's what the main criticism was, and that's what, you know, most people were complaining about. So now we've been in the same arena building this fan base and taping the shows in the same place, so you'll see in the second season that it's on camera, it's 100 times better, you know.
So now, one thing we actually kind of skipped over inadvertently, before we get to kind of this lightning round we want to hit, we kind of skipped over Ring of Honor, which is actually one of the biggest parts of your career, kind of where you became more of a mainstream name, and you held the Pure Wrestling Championship there and had a run as a heel and a face. Is there, you know, anything you want to discuss kind of about that run, or was it something you enjoyed, or was it, because this will tie into our eventual question of fan reaction, you know, you were kind of a polarizing figure during your time there. So if you want to talk a little bit about that run.
You know, Ring of Honor to me was, it was somewhere that every indie guy at that point almost had to go to get a name, you know. You know, I'm going to say had to go because there's guys that got signed, you know, to WWE that never went there. But it was a place to really, if you wanted to be a big name indie wrestler, you had to go there because other promoters would view you as more valuable if you were wrestling for Ring of Honor. And that was you looked at those PWI magazines, Ring of Honor was getting all the coverage. That's where all the good independent wrestlers were wrestling, and I wanted to wrestle the best. So I wanted to wrestle there, and, you know, I eventually did and started wrestling there. And, overall the experience was good. I mean, I haven't seen the product in a long time, but the problem with Ring of Honor when I was there is that every match was the main event. You know, it was these long shows. Every match was 30 minutes. And the booking was just, to me, was very very predictable. I mean, anybody can tell Samoa Joe and AJ Styles, go wrestle 30 minutes and their match is going to be good. But there was never an element of surprise in the booking. I never saw any upsets, not too often, stuff that said, wow. Overall, it was people talking about the matches, not so much the characters, you know. The booker at the time, he wanted to give me this gimmick of, you know, just be the silent baby face and just go kick people's asses. And to me, that wasn't who I was. I wanted to be more outspoken. I wanted to be that, you know, you saw me at Big Time Wrestling. I was more of a pussy chicken shit heel, you know. And to me, I got more of a reaction doing that and doing a lot less than going out there and trying to kill myself in that Ring of Honor style. So overall, I mean, the experience was good. It did definitely gave me exposure, but in the end, I think there is too many guys just trying to reinvent the wheel and trying to one-up the next guy when the show should be trying to build to a main event, and show should be a little tighter and not so many matches. So I think, it was just too much, and I think that's why they're suffering a little bit right now. I don't know, but I heard their houses were down. And where do you go from there? You can't go up if you've already, you know, quote-unquote blew your load so early. You know what I mean? So,
right.
There's only so where you can go, and especially right now where wrestling is so quiet, and there's MMA and there's UFC. This guy's really getting hit with blood. Who wants to go see fake fighting where you're getting punched in the face for real? You know, so it's just some of the things I don't agree with. But overall, they're probably still the top independent promotion. So,
And one of the things I think that annoys some casual viewers of their product, them along with TNA, kind of suffer from that old ECW mentality where the fans see themselves as part of the show instead of there to watch the show. And
course,
it seems like a lot of the fans are, you know, trying to kind of get themselves involved and get themselves over. And, you know, I think that also takes away from the product a little bit.
Yeah, well, you know, when I go to a movie theater and I watch a movie, I don't stand up and say, hey, this sucks. I watch it. If I don't like it, I don't come back, you know.
Right.
I don't try to steal the show from Liam Neeson or try to show up Denzel Washington. If I want to be a movie star and I want to criticize those guys, I'm going to go be a movie star. Not to say that everyone's going to like your style of wrestling, everyone's going to like who you are, but to say a certain guy sucks or that, you know, this is horrible, I wouldn't book this guy, and giving, you know, match ratings and this and that, who the fuck are you to give a match rating, you know what I mean? I understand guys that don't, you know, if you're going to have criticisms about things, out to try to make yourself seem like the be-all, end-all of, you know, rating matches and this and that just doesn't make any sense. Go to the show, shut the fuck up, and enjoy it, you know?
Yep.
You know, everyone wants to be a writer, Dave Meltzer, and they're not, you know? I'm not gonna
I think there is a way to do it, too, because I'm just going to kind of defend Scott myself a little bit, because that is one of the things that kind of got us, you know, launched us into doing these podcasts and whatnot, is that we do review, like, classic pay-per-view WWF events, but we do it, our whole goal is kind of do it as a more historical perspective and in a respectful way, but I see what you're saying, where there are a lot of people, you know, that do it in a, you know, way to kind of run down the talent and say what they think is a five-star match.
Yeah, well, and you can go and you can review the matches, but when you start talking insider stuff, like, you know, I remember one of my, you know, I'm not going to name names, but certain guys, like, just mark out for message board. Oh, what the fans think? What the fans think? They go read the message boards on. But when a fan says, "Oh, this match was good" or "this match was bad," you know, you take it with a grain of salt. Some people, you know, sometimes they're right. You know, sometimes I've had matches where they sucked and they were right. But to say a certain guy carried somebody or the reason this guy lost is because he's got heat with the booker, like, you don't fucking know shit. Like when they say stuff like that,
right.
This guy carried. Who are you? You've never stepped in a ring before. You're going to say this guy carried somebody? It doesn't make any. It doesn't make any sense to me. And that's the kind of at that point you just you know turn the volume down and say these guys don't know what the hell they're talking about, you know. So you know that kind of stuff gets irritating, but you know, it is what it is. You know, everyone pays money, everyone deserves to say what they want. But you know, look at the kids when they go to wrestling shows. They're so happy and they're just, you know, they're cheering and booing their favorites and the guys they don't like. When you start bringing notebooks there and you sit there miserable, it's just, why are you there? You know, I don't get it.
Good points, and it was a spirited defense you made, and I think you definitely raised a lot of valid points.
Yes, you did. I enjoyed that very much. One quick thing about Ring of Honor before we move on. I like the fact that you put that, because a lot of people say Ring of Honor is no, it's all wrestling. That's it's pure. It's, you know, that's where all the athleticism is. You know, all this writing and skits, and nobody wants to see that. People want to see guys beat the hell out of each other. But you made a good point about, you know, you have to have a little sizzle to go with the steak. And a lot of times it seems like Ring of Honor, all right, there's two guys beating the crap out of each other, and then what? Like, for instance, you had already left. I wanted to ask you this quick before we move on. Justin and I had actually gone to a Ring of Honor show in the summer of 2005. You had already left the promotion, I think, by then. One of my favorite, and I love heel stables. I mean, I've been a mark for the Horsemen since I was 10. And I loved Prince Nana's Embassy. What was he like? What was that setup like? Because that he really could, because he was going to, there was a woman in the promotion and he was going to smack her in the mouth and the place was going bonkers. And Prince, I mean, he really was bringing some serious heat.
Yeah, Prince Nana's great. His character is great. And, you know, working with him is funny as hell. There's times where you just want to break up and start laughing. And you're trying to keep a straight face because he's just so good and so, you know, so over the top. The Embassy was just something like I had asked for a heel turn long before I became heel. I felt like it was the way to go, and Gabe at the time disagreed and held off on me, and then, you know, eventually he agreed with me and turned me heel. But that was just, you know, I'm not sure where the Embassy stable came from, but I don't even know if they're still around or not. But excuse me. But yeah, it was cool. You know, working with him was great. I think it was too little, too late at that point for me. I think it could have happened a little sooner. You know, certain things in the booking I would have done different, but that's not my job. Like I said, I do what I'm told, and that's that. You know, it's my Ring of Honor time was cool, and I just want to set the record straight. I left Ring of Honor. I didn't get fired. People email me all the time and say, if they take you back, would you go back? Like, you know, I left wrestling for 5 months. I took time off, and I quit every wrestling promotion I worked for. And when I came back, that one Ring of Honor show, promoter at Gabe had emailed me and asked me to come back for one show. I never got fired. People say that all the time, that I got fired because I lost to Chris Masters when I was a pure champ. I lost the belt and I left that promotion because I asked to leave. You know, so just want to set that record straight too.
Good.
You know?
So, John, now that we kind of went through your career, we do have some questions here we want to kind of hit in a lightning round kind of style.
Okay.
So I'm going to let Scott start that off, and then we'll kind of see where each one leads.
Okay. All right. Number one, John. A lot of people have said that WWE's developmental system, which pretty much right now is just Tampa, is not doing very well at all. It's somewhat unorganized. They said the training's kind of so-so. Triple H has been told, we've read that once he starts getting more control on the company end of it, he wants to totally revamp it. What are your thoughts on the developmental scheme in WWE from what you know, and do you think it needs tinkering or work?
Well, Kevin Kelly, you know, guys know who Kevin Kelly is, used to be a broadcaster.
Right.
He's actually working for Lucha Libre USA now. He's one of the commentators for the second season. He brought up a good point. I was talking to him a couple weeks ago. He said that WWE in 5 years has fired 150 guys, developmental and you know, other guys. If you're firing that many guys in 5 years that you've invested money in, then someone's fucking up bad. You know, whether it's a guy scouting the talent, whether it's the training. But there's a reason you're signing these guys. If you can't, quote-unquote, find something for them, the writers have nothing for you, fire the writers. Don't fire the guys that are signing their life away and going there and doing what they're told, you know. Which isn't the case for everybody. Some guys might screw up too, but you know, if you're not producing the kind of talent that you should be producing with that kind of money and that kind of guys that you're signing, it just doesn't make any sense. So something's wrong. Kevin Kelly mentioned that too, that Triple H said he was going to revamp it, and I hope he does, because I don't know. I mean, back in the '80s. Remember the guys used to come out to vignettes and stuff? I mean,
right.
They already had their experience. Those guys were over before they even came on TV. Now you're getting guys with barely an experience coming onto TV wrestling the same exact way because they didn't wrestle in territories. They didn't do independence. They wrestled the same 20, 30 guys in Tampa. There's only so many moves they're going to know, so many styles that they're going to have learned. I remember my friend went to a house show like 3-4 years ago with a bunch of developmental guys, and the cutoff spot was a, you know, throwing a dropkick, the guy holds onto the ropes, the guy falls on his back. Like, four different guys did that, and it's ridiculous.
And actually, a couple follow-ups of that. What do you, we actually had this discussion on our previous show, kind of that it seems like they skipped a generation of guys that they could have used to kind of fill this gap, this drought of, like, main stars they have. You know, obviously early in the decade, you still had those Attitude Era guys. And then it seems like they kind of skipped over that whole Benoit, Jericho, Guerrero. They kind of gave them such a brief run before really, you know, jump-starting the Cena and Batista and Orton and those guys. And now those guys have been on top, you know, for almost 6-7 years at this point. I mean, that was Hogan's whole run in the 80s, and they're still, you know, obviously guys that are going to be here for a while. So that's kind of where that hole, and you know, from the developmental system comes in, that these guys are being rushed up because they kind of didn't really plan to let those guys in their 30s who had all that experience kind of run with the ball for a while. Is that something you agree with?
Yeah, I definitely agree with it, and I don't understand it. You look back in the 60s and 70s, you know, when the guys like Bruno Sammartino and Kowalski, look at the houses they drew, wrestling was selling itself, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I agree that people should learn how to talk, and, you know, I've worked tenfold on that. My promos are 100 times better now. My crowd interaction is better. That was something I kind of ignored when I first started because I was, you know, more of a mark for the wrestling, too. But, excuse me, I'm having a cough attack.
No problem.
Yeah,
it's okay.
Those guys, wrestling sold itself. It should be that way now too. You know, the promos are needed, but yeah, I don't understand why guys who have it sometimes they're not given a chance. So I don't really understand. I think people evaluating talent might need to get better glasses or something. I'm not exactly sure what it is. I don't know if certain guys are hard to deal with. There's so many intangibles. You know, a guy might be great, but he might be an asshole. And I agree 100%. If a guy's an asshole, he shouldn't get a job, you know, because the cancer in the locker room, somebody that doesn't want to do certain things for the good of the company shouldn't be there. But there have definitely been a lot of guys that got skipped over, and I personally don't know why, but somebody might, or there might not be a reason at all, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, the big story, John, going around in wrestling is that in WWE, if the next few months is it for Triple H in the ring, whether he does retire at WrestleMania or whatever happens in the next year, he is the future of the company, at least in terms of the hierarchy. What do you think about that? Do you think that's a good thing for the company that he would be kind of getting a much higher role? What are your thoughts on that, considering the times you've been there?
You know, I don't really know. You know, he's one of Kowalski's students, and I've had, you know, some conversations with him. I've talked to him. He actually paid for Kowalski's funeral, from what I understand. So, you know, I think he's probably a businessman, and that might translate to being a prick to some people. I've always seen him as pretty pleasant, but I've also never been in a position where I could take his job. So who knows how he really is, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. I think if you look at his in-ring work, he's phenomenal. He's one of the best wrestlers ever, you know. I think he's underrated because you look at guys like Shawn Michaels and Guerrero, Benoit, Angle, those guys were so technically sound. But I think Triple H is just as good as all of them, you know. And he's had a pretty good longevity. So I don't know. I mean, I don't know him on a personal level and what his intentions are to judge whether or not he would be good, being in control there. I think he already is pretty much in a little bit of control. So,
where you think maybe the direction of the product will go as far as, I don't know if you have any take on that, because a lot of people, are kind of hoping maybe he will bring wrestling back to its, 80s glory days. He was a guy who grew up, reportedly as a big NWA fan, a big Ric Flair fan. Do you see him maybe kind of, bringing a lot of those qualities back and kind of trying to get back more into that,
Yeah, I think so. I don't think anything can hurt, the business needs a shot in the arm. I know The Rock came back and everyone was talking about that, but they need to build their own stars, too. They can't rely on guys from the past. And whether they need a guy like Triple H who's experienced years and years of wrestling to help them develop those stars, then anything's going to help. But they definitely need some change because even though they are the only show in town right now, they could probably be a lot more profitable than they are, and they could be having more stimulated stories. If you look at back in the 90s, the Attitude Era, late 90s, early 2000s, whatever it was, someone said 9 million people every Monday night were watching wrestling. It's not nearly as many now. Mm-hmm.
Right.
And TNA is not competition for WWE. I don't think they ever will be. They've had 9 years. They had enough time to try to prove themselves, and they've done anything.
Seems like they spin their wheels more than anything.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, yeah, it's just awesome roster, awesome wrestlers, insulting storylines, It's like a kindergartner sees through that bullshit, No, I think WWE is the only show in town. They always will be, but their product isn't as good as it can be. But I'm also not a writer. I wrestle, so I don't know. Definitely needs some change, and if it means having somebody like him helping change it, then I think it'd definitely be a good thing. It can't hurt.
If you if either of them called you right now, Dixie Carter or Vince, maybe not personally, but although that would be kind of cool, wouldn't it? If either of them called you right now, would you go?
WWE, absolutely, yeah. Right now in my career, I'm 31 years old. First things first, I'm under contract to Lucha Libre, so I can't go anywhere,
Right, so mm-hmm. hypothetically.
And I'm hoping they grow because I love my character. I love that they give me the opportunity, and right now they are my priority. But if WWE, if I had a free contract, WWE called me, of course. Who doesn't want one big run with them to make good money to be wrestling in front of thousands of people every week? Who doesn't want that, Sure, I would go there. TNA, if I went to TNA, I would probably be the biggest hypocrite in the world because all I've done is bash them for years. And I haven't watched them in years. But, I don't think I could ever in a million years go there. I think I'd rather go bag groceries
excellent.
than go wrestle for them. It's just... I try, every 6 months, 7 months, I try to turn it back on, and I see this. And when you have guys like Ric Flair, Mick Foley, Hogan, and Angle, these skilled performers in there, and you can't put out stimulating storylines that make people want to watch it, it's insulting, So I don't think I could ever wrestle for TNA, but they offer me some crazy amount of money. Who's going to say I wouldn't go? But I. Wouldn't happen, and no, I couldn't. I don't think I could do it. Hold on one sec, all right?
Sure.
Okay. All right, go ahead, guys. Yeah, I'm ready.
Okay, so I kind of have one of these questions. It's one of those old age-old debates that people get into on these message boards and blogs and stuff. Uh-huh. You look at a guy like Loki or Caval, who just had a quick run in WWE before being released. There's always that argument. What are you better off doing? Being a role player in WWE, maybe only having a 3-minute match, but making good money, traveling the world for the biggest promotion, or being on the indie scene, having more say over your career, longer matches, kind of getting to maybe show yourself more creatively. What's the better spot? Is it an individualistic thing, or is it?
Of course, yeah. It's all personal preference. I mean, you could say, oh, you make more money in WWE, but maybe some guys have a really good side job and they want to do the indies and they don't really care about the money. But if you're talking about financially, yeah, WWE is the way to go. For me, that would be the way to go. I'd rather be a small fish in a big pond than get a huge ovation from 175 people every weekend. You know what I mean?
Right.
I'd rather go out there, have easier matches, have some Hold on one sec. I'm ready. You there?
Yes.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, go ahead. I'm going to put you on hold for one sec, all right?
Mm-hmm. Sure, John.
Is that going to screw you up?
No, no, go ahead.
All right,
we'll
hold on.
Fill some time. So you guys are listening right now, Place to Be Podcast, Scott Griscolo, Justin Rosero. Pretty good conversation so far we're having with John Walter. Scott, you have any takeaways so far?
I love his analogy about Ring of Honor, mm-hmm. that he finally, somebody has the guts. And you know, we have very good friends who love Ring of Honor. But I'm glad that somebody's finally saying, you know what, just having a bunch of athletic guys beating the shit out of each other is not good enough. You do need a little sizzle. There are some times in WWE's history there's too much sizzle and not enough steak. But there are cases in Ring of Honor where there's too much steak and not enough sizzle. And John's exactly right. You need to kind of build something around these guys and maybe let them have some lesser, you know, you don't have to spend 45 minutes beating the crap out of each other. You know, you can have a series of 8, 9, 12-minute matches and have some good, you know, interaction and around it than just going out there and wrestling for 45 minutes and then not doing anything after that. So I think
it comes down to, though, what they want to be. If they want to be a national promotion, then yes, I think that you're exactly right. That's what they need to do. But if they're happy with their niche market, you know, being a promotion that tours around every now and then, has a big show now and then.
Sorry, guys. I'm good.
Okay, John. All right, Scott, we'll pick up this conversation at a later date.
No problem.
Kind of debating your Ring of Honor points, John. But, all right, so moving on here, I kind of have three topics that tie into one, and I just want to get your take on all three of them. Obviously, it's the WWE wellness policy.
Yep.
Steroid usage and your experience, whether or not, you know, you don't have to get into whether, you know, your personal usage at all. I don't think you ever
uh-huh.
have. But
nope.
And also along with the Chris Benoit situation, because I knew he was someone that you really looked up to. I remember that, you know, back in college, I was one of your favorite guys. And I do know you always spoke very reverently about him whenever you worked for WWE and the way he would treat you, and you mentioned that earlier. So maybe just kind of hit all three of those points, as they all do kind of tie in.
So the wellness policy, I've talked to guys that have been in WWE before, and they say it's comprehensive, but also guys say that if you're making a ton of money for WWE, there's no way you're going to get busted for drugs, you know? I know they said the magic thing that happens is all of a sudden someone gets an injury and they're off TV for a little while. I also heard it's like three strikes or something. So, you know, I don't know how comprehensive it is. If you look at some of those guys and you think they're natural, then you're out of your mind. You know what I mean?
Right.
So there's, I'm sure there's loopholes in it. I'm sure if you're not making any money for WWE and all of a sudden you get banged for marijuana or steroids, I'm sure you're going to get fired quick, you know? So it's, you know. But what pro sports are, you know, you look at some of those football players, some of those basketball players, and, you know, guys in, you know, back in the Mark McGwire scandal, Barry Bonds, how many of those guys are all naturals, you know? It's not many, mm-hmm. you know?
And those are actual competitive sports where that can affect the outcome. In a world of wrestling, it's really just about getting ahead, and it doesn't affect the outcome of the matches.
I agree, and I've never used steroids in my life, hand to God. I've never used them, but in pro wrestling, personally, I don't think it should matter if guys use it or not. It's you know, guys in Hollywood use it for a certain look. Why can't pro wrestlers do it too? You know, it's not like you said; it's not affecting the outcome of a match, and it's not. Oh man, he won the match because he was on steroids. Well, he won the match because he was written that way. You know,
right. yeah.
So no, I don't think I don't. Matter, but it's my personal choice, as it is everybody else's, to whether you want to take it or not. And I never have, and it's not for me. You know.
Well, yeah, you've been jacked and cut since junior year of college. I can definitely vouch for that. So you've been in ridiculous shape as long as I've known you. So,
well, you know, you gotta work hard, and it's not easy. But I'd rather take the long road and maybe not make as much money, but you know, be able to have my liver when I'm 50. You know,
mm-hmm.
but like I said, it's personal choice, it's personal preference. It's, for some guys, it's a sacrifice they make, and I'm not going to judge somebody on what they decide to do. You know.
Mm-hmm.
As for the Benoit situation, it was horrible. I'm sure, you know, people said everyone had the same story about him, that he was a good guy, that he was very helpful. He was very helpful to the newer guys, but clearly he was messed up, you know, and whether it was steroids, it was brain damage, it was depression, it was a bad marriage or a combination of everything, he probably just snapped, and that's my guess, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I had some dealings with him in person over email, and you could tell he just was a great guy and he cared about wrestling, but he wasn't all there. And when people say they didn't see it coming, I barely spent any time with him on the road as much as other guys did, and I could see it, you know. It really didn't surprise me. It was shocking, but when I heard about it, it wasn't a boatload of a surprise, because you could just tell. One week he would talk to me, the next week he didn't remember me. So he definitely had some issues, I'm sure, and I think ultimately his quest to be the best wrestler ultimately consumed him too, because he was so obsessed with wrestling. He probably didn't give his body a break, and all those bumps in Japan, and he was always in phenomenal shape too. So we'll question whether he was cycling the stuff or he was just constantly on drugs all the time. So it's a shame, but it's a tragedy, and it's not just from wrestling. Too many people blame steroids, but that was just a guy who did that to his body, made his own choices, and whether he was in his own state of mind or not, it was him that did it. It wasn't wrestling,
Mm-hmm. Mm. It seemed like he followed the path of the man he always idolized, and that was Dynamite Kid. That reckless, load your body up with drugs and go out there and kill yourself to be the best. A little bit of maybe that short man complex mixed in, but
that happens,
Did you see did you see a lot of steroids? Obviously I don't want you to name names, but I mean, did you see it rampant in the indies? I don't necessarily Ring of Honor, because I know those guys, I'm not sure how those guys would think about it, but in the indies, did you see a lot of it kind of flowing around? Was it rampant in the overseas more than here?
You don't personally see it. I don't see guys dealing it, there's guys who would admit to it. Most guys who take steroids will admit to it. And there are other guys who pose MySpace and Facebook pages with them posing that says all natural, and then 3 hours later they're telling their friends what they're taking. So there's a lot of phonies out there. Mm. I don't like telling guys, hey, I'm all natural, and bragging about it, because who's to believe me? Because there's so many guys that say that are full of shit. I believe it. God believes me, because I've never taken that shit. So for me, it's not something I want to go out and advertise. I'm proud of it, but nobody should believe anything else that somebody says, because a lot of people are full of crap. A lot tons of guys take it. Yeah, of course, but whether or not specific guys use it or not, I can't say. I've heard different guys tell me they have, and other guys tell me they haven't, when I know they have, because they told other guys they have. It's pretty popular in all of wrestling, and not just wrestling, everywhere. Look at kids that go to the clubs every Friday night and gel their hair and wear the tightest shirt possible, throw them in the dryer before they go out. It's everywhere. It's not just in pro wrestling, not just in sports. It's in gyms. It's in it's everywhere in the world. And like I said, I think there's ways to use it smartly. But if you don't need it medically, I don't think that should be taken. That's just my opinion. But it is what it is.
Talking about some of the guys in your career that you've worked with, and both as tag team partners, managers. One of the guys, obviously, that you're very well known to have worked with was John Cena Sr., obviously father of John Cena. What was he like to work with as a manager? Obviously, we saw you interact with him at that show in Beverly in 2009. But what kind of guy was he like backstage to deal with? Is he cool? Justin and I actually said hi to him in the Boston Garden, or the TD Bank Garden lobby before the 2008 Survivor Series. He seemed like a pretty good guy. He was walking around talking to people. What kind of guy is he to work with?
Oh, he's very fun to work with, and he loves it. He's a guy who has a full-time job, a really good job. I think he might have just retired. He's actually a justice of the peace and marries people too on the side, and did really well for himself outside of wrestling. I think he just does this because he really enjoys it, and I think being John Cena's dad is a good thing for him, because it actually gets him bookings. People book him because he's John Cena's dad. So working with him is great. He's really good on the microphone. He's a really believable character, and my only criticism of him is sometimes he's supposed to be this villain manager, and he's chit-chatting with the fans outside, which drives me up the wall. It is what it is. The guy's having fun. He's getting his little taste of the business, and it's good for him. He enjoys it, and he's always been good to me, and always a pleasure to work with. So not really anything bad to say about him.
All the guys you've ever worked with in this business, dark matches, indies, both in Ring of Honor, obviously, and in WWE, who is probably your favorite star, top-of-the-line guy? You've wrestled a lot of guys in dark matches and on Velocity in WWE. Who was your favorite guy, your absolute favorite guy to be in the ring with?
As a person or as a wrestler?
Both.
Both?
Mm.
Is that what you said?
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's tough when you're doing velocity and heat matches because, you know, you're going out there, you're doing 5-6 minutes, and your job is to make other guys look good, and that's good, that's fine, you know, that's what you're employed to do, but you can't really feel, you know, how good somebody is or have a great match with them because it's not your time to have your good match. So the indies is where you really have those kind of matches, you know. One of my favorite guys to wrestle was Tatanka. I got a chance to wrestle him for Big Time Wrestling. We had like a 25-30 minute match, and it was awesome. He was a great guy, and he was one of the legends that I worked with that actually wanted to go out there and have a good match, you know, who really wanted to go out there and cared about working hard. So that was cool, you know. He did a show for Lucha Libre USA a couple months ago, and we got to hang out again. So he's a class act, and he's a good guy. But you know, I've been lucky. I haven't had really too many bad experiences with any guys that I've wrestled. I wrestled Bob Holly twice, and you hear so many Bob Holly stories that he was a prick. And I found him fun to work with too. You know, he was really he was tight. He was hitting me hard, but he took it back and enjoyed it. And you know, I don't have anything bad to say about him either. So, you know, there's good and bad from every guy. But I would say Tatanka was my favorite by far. I got to work with guys like Ric Flair in Big Time Wrestling too, and he was cool. You know, awesome to work with a guy like that. But anytime you watch guys as a kid and you get back to work with them, it's a cool feeling. So, I can pick out a favorite, but everybody was good.
Mm. And now on the other side of the coin, and again, if you don't want to name names, we're more than happy to accept that, obviously working your way up, you said you do deal with a lot of really good guys and you deal with a lot of not so great guys. Were there any real grade A douchebags that you've come along that you've run into in your travails that you could say, this guy's a real dick?
You know, I wish I could say yeah, but I really don't have anybody, believe it or not. Everyone's pretty much, and there's guys that other guys would say are an asshole, but I've never judged people on what other people think. It's how I interact with them, and everybody's treated me really well. But I've also carried myself with respect and respected other people and been polite, so I think that helps out. A lot of guys are assholes, so they're going to be treated like an asshole, and they're going to say, "Oh, that guy's an asshole." But realistically, you were a prick first, you know.
Mm.
So no, I don't have any enemies. I don't have any heat with anybody, and I've always kind of just treated this as a business and try not to get too personal with the people because, you know, it's what I want to do for a living. It's where I want to make money. So I haven't really gotten too personal with people, and that's where a lot of times shit goes bad when you start, you know, hanging out with people outside of wrestling and start dating people in wrestling. That's when things get fucked up. So I can't name a name and say that I've had a problem with somebody who's a prick. So
You also someone, that too, that it seems like you've made a conscious effort to, you know, kind of stay down to or stay in touch. You know, I can say it personally, stay in touch with people that you knew, you know, before you kind of achieved the success, and I think that probably plays a role, too, that you do kind of keep a level head about, you know, what you do and who you are. You know, you've done some great things. You've done things that people can never dream of doing, traveling the world and doing what you love and being on TV, but you've always kind of, you know, been sure to kind of keep in touch with the people, you know, that you knew growing up, and I think that plays a big role in how you've kind of conducted yourself as well.
Well, yeah, I mean, everybody, you know, whether a guy is sweeping the streets or a guy's pumping gas, everyone's working for a living. No one's better than another person, you know. And also on the flip side of that, just because someone's a pro wrestler and they're a star and they're in WrestleMania doesn't mean I want to hang out with them. If you're a dickhead or if you're somebody that does stuff I don't do, why would I want to hang out with you? Because I'm not a mark, you know. I'm not going to see someone go, "Oh, he was in the main event of WrestleMania. Hey, let's go have a drink." Mm-hmm. If you're not my friend, you're not my friend, you know. So real friends stick around, and fake ones, which is a lot of fake people in wrestling, they disappear quick. So I've never sacrificed my real friends or, you know, my morals for a weekend friend, you know. So just not the kind of person I am.
Okay, so we have a little story we wanted to maybe get a little anecdote about. The WrestleMania 20, you were one of the druids for Undertaker's return.
Yep.
Against Kane. And from where Scott and I were sitting, we kind of had a little angle backstage, and we saw a fire break out. Do you have any details on how that fire broke out back there?
You know, it definitely happened, and I don't really remember because I was one of the first guys to go out, but I'm pretty sure it was Billy Kryptonite who went on to wrestle with one of the dicks.
Oh, yeah.
Chad. He came up in Chaotic. We wrestled a bunch of times, and, you know, we trained together, but I'm pretty sure it was his foot that caught on fire, and I think they put it out real quick, but I don't really remember what happened, but... Yeah, it's I'm sure it was embarrassing for him. And but you know, you're dealing with those fire and those sticks we were holding up were heavy as fucking hell. You know, to hold it up there for 15 minutes, my arms were trembling. You know, and I work out heavy. You know, so I'm surprised not more stuff happened. Like, you know, we didn't drop it on the Undertaker's head when he was walking by, because those things were heavy, and it took a lot to hold them up. You know, but yeah, the guy's feet definitely caught on fire, and it wasn't tragic, thank God. You know.
What was it like being at that show? Because at the time, you know, one of the biggest shows in the promotion's history.
They really started to
embrace that historical aspect of the company.
Yeah, being in WrestleMania was cool, but just Madison Square Garden alone, you know, the locker room sucked. It was so crammed, you know. But other than that, it was, yeah, you know, watching Benoit win the title, watching Benoit and Guerrero in the locker room afterwards together with the belts, that was cool, you know. And the atmosphere, you could definitely tell it was a big-time show.
You know? Yeah. Did you go to the after party, the famous WrestleMania after party?
I did not go, no. I think that was my, like, third. I think I had wrestled for Chaotic Friday night, wrestled for Ring of Honor Saturday, did WrestleMania Sunday, then had Raw and SmackDown Monday and Tuesday, so it was the only thing I wanted to do.
Hmm. I have to say, John, it's impressive, because that was actually my first, and I've been a wrestling fan for 28, almost 30 years. It's kind of sad, but see, I'm actually dating myself. Waiting for the old jokes to come. Everybody else does, but and I have to say that was my first ever show at Madison Square Garden. So it was amazing. It was amazing. It's pretty awesome that you were a part of it, I have to say.
Yeah, for sure.
So kind of our last question here, we want to hit you with. So actually, I got two more, but how would you respond? And I don't know if you ever read the stuff or even aware of it. I think you were, because I think we were talking about it at the time during your run in Ring of Honor. You were very polarizing. Those are very passionate fans, whether good or bad. And, you know, you were riffed quite a bit, you know, online for either being a little too bland or maybe not really kind of living up to their expectations of what you should be in that role. And a lot of people weren't, you know, too happy with you winning that pure title, thinking you weren't really accomplished enough in the ring. You know, how do you kind of, how did you deal with that? Was it something you did deal with, or is there anything you kind of have to say about that?
Oh, I agree 100% on the fact that I shouldn't have won the pure title, and I had called Gabe, the promoter, a couple weeks before and told him that I didn't think I should. When you're going to put the second highest belt in the company on somebody, you want to build them up. I spent the 4 months before that losing to every match, and then all of a sudden I won the title. It didn't make any sense to me. If you wanted me to come in and just drop two guys and put them over, that's fine with me. That's what I would have done, but to have me lose to, you know, Generation Next for 3 months and not win a match and then all of a sudden win a title, it just didn't make any sense to me. So I suspected the backlash and exactly what happened. So I told him I didn't want it, but he said, I think you'll elevate the title and this and that. But I didn't agree, but again, you do what you're told, you know. As for being bland and stuff, I mean, like I said, what they told me when I got hired was, we want you to be the baby face that doesn't say anything. Just go out there and be a technical kick-ass heel, and that's what I tried to do, you know. It wasn't me. I didn't feel comfortable doing it, but, you know, it was what it was. And even as working for Ring of Honor, I tried to keep some kind of psychology to my matches where, you know, hey, a baby face does this, a heel does this, but a lot of the guys in Ring of Honor would just go out there and do all their moves, you know. And I think I should have been a little more selfish when I was there, because a lot of guys were, you know, they're working for themselves. And that probably would have helped me a little bit. But, you know, I don't have any regrets. It is what it is. And my promos back then weren't that great, I'll admit it, you know. But I've worked on them since then, and didn't get the microphone a ton of times. So for people to say that I was bland, like, well, how many promos did they cut in the ring? Did you ever see me cut an in-ring promo in Ring of Honor, you know?
Mm-hmm.
you know, so there's only so much you can do with what they give you, you know. Got to make the best of it. So, no, you know, it never got to me. In the end, I was getting booked, I was getting paid, and I was, you know, getting exposure to other places too. So it wasn't a huge deal. You know, I'm not not going to cry about something like that.
All right. So the final question we kind of wrap up with is, you know, you did mention you grew up a big time fan, lifelong fan. Obviously, for you to go through what you've been through, you would have to be. Has being in the business and your experience in the business affected that at all? Or are you still, you know, a big-time fan, will you still throw in a match from 1988, 1989, and still enjoy it the same way? Are you more critical of it, or are you more appreciative of it, or has anything changed in that regard?
I'm a big fan still of older style wrestling, yeah. You ask me to watch today's stuff, I really can't do it, and I don't know if it's because I'm in the business now or because It's just not that very good. There are a lot of bright spots. Don't get me wrong. There are a lot of guys who are good out there, WWE, TNA, but maybe it's I've just been wrestling for the past 11 years, and that's all I've been doing, that maybe, you know, I just don't want to watch it anymore. I'd rather watch Law & Order, you know?
Well,
but, no, I wouldn't say I'm more critical of it, because when I watch it, I still try to watch it as a fan, maybe with a little more critical eye, because you're actually trying to learn more than just be entertained. But, no, I'm still a fan, definitely. If there's a good wrestling match that I hear about, I will watch it. But I just think that, you know, doing it on the weekends, you know, traveling and, you know, going to these airports, doing these TV tapings, then coming home, you just kind of want to get away from it and not necessarily just be consumed with wrestling. So I'm still a fan. I still watch it if it's good stuff, but it's not like I was just starting and I'm watching it all the time. I've definitely scaled back a lot.
Cool. So I think that's all I have, Scott. Did you have any other kind of follow-up questions?
No, I've had a blast, John. It has been an absolute treat to have you talk with us.
I appreciate it.
And, you know, good luck in the future. And you opened our eyes to a lot of stuff. I'm telling you, the Ring of Honor stuff you told me, I'm still blown away by that. I never heard anybody ever say something like that about Ring of Honor. And obviously you with experience being able to back up what you said. And again, very impressed. Good job. I was very impressed by that.
All right. Thanks, guys. I appreciate it.
Nathan, you want to plug John before you take off?
Not really. You know, my website doesn't exist anymore, so I can't plug my website. I think I stiffed my webmistress a couple times, never paid her, so I think the website shut down. But I still have a Facebook page if people want to look me up. Right now, Lucha Libre USA is pretty much the only stuff I'm doing. LuchaLibreUSA.com will probably, they got a Facebook page too, will probably update everybody on when season two is coming. And I definitely think people should watch it because it's going to be a lot better than the first season, and you know, hopefully there'll be a lot of bright spots and it'll continue to grow.
Cool. Well, we're Excellent. Definitely looking forward to that premiering later this year, and you know, once we do kind of get word of when, maybe you can let me know, you know, exactly when you hear about an air date, and then we can go ahead and let our listeners know about that. Make sure they tune in. So definitely want to thank you for coming on. It was I know we had some scheduling issues, but we got you in, and it was a great time. It was good catching up with you. And
you too, buddy.
Keep doing the keep fighting the good fight, man. Go talk to Rubino and have some ice cream for us.
Yeah, all right, guys, be good. Take care.
All right, buddy.
Thanks, John.
All right, bye.
Okay, so we're gonna go ahead and wrap things up here from the Place to Be podcast. That was our interview with John Walters. It was pretty informative, and Scott, maybe on our next show we'll kind of break down a little bit and get into some of the stuff he talked about. And also coming later this week is our WrestleMania 3 review. We're gonna go ahead and get that done. And coming up next couple weeks, we have a Big East tournament podcast we're going to do, and then the night of Selection Sunday, which is in a couple weeks, we're going to do a big podcast. Then we're going to have myself, you, Matt Rotella, Andrew Reich, and your brother on, all big college basketball guys, to talk about seedings. We're going to give some bracket predictions, kind of who got snubbed, and all that kind of stuff. So
how much we can attempt to stomach watching tournament games on TBS and TNT, because God knows their baseball playoff coverage sucked.
So. Hey, you know what? That was better being on TV than not. So.
Well, that's true, too. Yeah, and CBS had somebody to foot half the bill. So.
Very true. So, all right, that's it. So for Scott, my PIC, this is Justin Rosero, and we will see you later this week. Thanks for listening.